was very reticent to take an open stand on this, and everything he said that was negative about Herb's points of view was muted, and you had to read between the lines to understand what he was saying.
I never knew him, but I've heard about him and I've read a lot of stuff. But it seemed to me he was desperate to avoid getting into these ad hominem aspects.
Yeah.
He wanted to keep it on a kind of detached scientific.
In fact, he never wanted to use the term non-classical.
Yeah, yeah. To
use that on the book.
Yeah.
But also, everybody talks about him as being a real gentleman.
Well, he was, I think, and he really felt very uncomfortable with this combative aspect of things, and he didn't appreciate the name calling. I mean, really flat out name calling. The business with a gun on the table, and you know, a joke is a joke, but you can only go so far. No, I think that a very deep antagonism grew up between Herb Brown and Saul Weinstein, and that was the motor that kept this thing going, and which caused a lot of smoke. And in my view, some people say that I have very, very strong opinions about this. I think that Herb's influence in this field was basically negative. I think that the case for a non-classical structure was pretty sound. I think that Saul pushed this about as far as it could go based on indirect evidence, and he had as strong a case as could be mounted. You could adhere to the Brown point of view only by the invocation of epicycles and various ad hoc hypotheses which did not flow from the internal structure of the subject. So I was convinced about this long before Herb was, and it seemed to me that by prolonging this, he was creating a point of contention that it was like a vortex that sucked large portions of the physical organic community into it, and whereas there were many, many other problems out there that needed to be addressed, so all this talent went into solving what, in my opinion, was an already solved problem.
Much time I always comment that it hurt him to see all this brain power wasted on this. And he said, there were really important problems out there. I mean, just take the problem of oxidation or almost anything else.
Sure. There were just massive numbers of problems, and so it was kind of a drain on the whole field. And in a way, I have to plead guilty because I was part of it. I was a participant, and I got very involved in it. And I saw the point of diminishing returns, and I faded out of the picture long before a lot of other people did. But nevertheless, I made my little contribution to it, and I don't feel that I totally regret that, in the sense that I learned a lot about how to do research from the work that I did in the non-classical ion field. I think the methyl norbornyl stuff, for example, was a case in point. You mentioned that.
That's a paper that you recommended that I look at. So why don't we talk about that?
Yeah.
What led you into it? I mean,
it was 1967 already, but by then you were doing work. That was the Wisconsin work.
Yeah, that started at Wisconsin long before 67.
Yes, you had 40 pages in a journal.
Yeah. It was a culmination of a lot of work. Let's see. How did we get into it? The objective of that study and of another study, which we did with Phil Grubb, was to study the stereochemistry of these shifts. the vicinal and the transannular shifts in norbornal cation. Now, I must say that Paul Bartlett had been working somewhat along this line, but he'd been studying a system in which the migrating group was an aerial group. I don't know that whether he ever published that, but if he did, he didn't make a big deal out of it. But I think he came to the conclusion that at least he thought that the shift should be in the vicinal hydrogen or the vicinal shift. It should shift on the exoside because it was going to a place where there was a delocalized cation, and the bottom side, the endoside, was being occupied in this partial valence with the bridging carbon atom, so that the migrant group should come over from the other side. So our thought was let's investigate this, but let's simplify the system a lot, and so we took the aryl group off, and we made the migrant group a hydrogen. And for that, so in order to provide a thermodynamic driving force for that, we wanted the methyl group on the origin of migration, so that after it migrated, you would have a tertiary cation left. Now, so we studied this in the case of the 2-norbornyl 3-methyl cation. And there are two isomers of that. In one of them, the methyl is endo, and the hydrogen is exo, and then the other one, just the reverse. So the prediction would have been, following up on this idea of Bartlett's, which we then fleshed out more, the idea would have been that in the hydrogen migration, to give the tertiary cation, the hydrogen should migrate from the exo side, okay, rather than from the endo side. So the thought was that if you start out with the leaving group at the two position, bromobenzene sulfonate or tosylate, and then the methyl group at the three position, if the methyl group is endo, then the hydrogen will be exo. That should migrate very readily to the two position because it's stereoelectronically favorable and it gives a tertiary cation. On the other hand, if you start out with the exomethyl group, the hydrogen will be endo, then the migration will be stereoelectronically unfavorable. And what would it do then? Well, first thing we did was to try that reaction. And what we thought was, if this prohibition against the migration is really a strong prohibition, you shouldn't get that tertiary product, or if you do get it, it should come from some completely different mechanism. Now, what we found was that in the case where the methyl group is endo and the hydrogen, the three position, was exo, it went very cleanly to the tertiary cation. And we showed by essentially stereochemical labeling, by using enantiomerically enriched reactants, that was a direct hydrogen shift. It was just going by an exo to exo shift and was producing the rearranged cation with no monkey business, no fancy mechanism, just as you would expect for the migration of a hydrogen to a secondary center in order to produce a tertiary center. But now when we change those two things, we put the hydrogen in the endo position and the methyl in the exo position. Now this hydrogen that wants to migrate there ultimately can't do it because of this stereochemical prohibition. So what does it do? Well, it turns out that it goes through this circuitous mechanism of successive 6-2, 3-2, 6-2 shifts, and it goes all the way around Robin Hood's bond, and it ends up giving you the enantiomerically opposite isomer of the same tertiary cation. So these two epimers of the labeled starting material produce, with complete stereochemical specificity, the opposite enantiomers. So this convinced us that there must be a very strong prohibition against endo migration. And that was to us, that was a very powerful piece of evidence in favor of the non-classical cation. Now, who told me this? Winstein never said he agreed with me about this. I think the best he said was, oh, that's very interesting, or something like that. But someone recently wrote me that he had had a conversation with Winstein around 1967 or thereabouts, and Winstein said to this person, I can't remember who the hell was, that you know that this non-classical thing is correct for a lot of reasons, not least of which is the observation that these migrations are XOXO. So whether he would admit it to me or not,
he wasn't about to give you
it made an impact on him.
All right, I think Barlett published a different paper of yours with laminate.
Yeah, that's a different, that's on a deamination, yeah. Yeah, Bartlett smoothed that one over too. That we got into a big fight with Corey there, which is a story I don't particularly want to go into. I mean, we won the fight, but it is more to it than that, which I don't choose to talk about. It was.
I got a few questions. One is in that paper.
Which one?
The one we're talking about now.
The methyl norbornyl cation. Yeah.
Right. At the end of that, you go into this LCAO argument, right? And
yeah.
You're talking about the linear versus the bent.
Yeah.
When did you start using that kind of analysis? Because now this is something, again, where resonance is not going to tell you anything.
No.
Right?
No.
It's basically got to come out of some kind of MO type.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I really would like to hear about, you know, when you started to use.
Well, the line there is very clear. What got me going on this was the Woodward Hoffman papers starting in 1965, but I had heard Hoffman lecture on orbital symmetry as early as 63 or 64, and it was like somebody turning a light on in a dark room, because I realized that there was a whole, and in fact, you know, that Michael Dewar was saying this kind of stuff long before, but he again couched it in this very lapidary mathematical style, which was very off-putting to organic chemists. Nobody could read those damn papers. What does this all mean? How can we use it? Well, Hoffman was just sort of a homebody, and he put this in our language. And I picked up on that, and I began trying to use that type of argument, the orbitals interacting with each other and so on.
You weren't very long in your orbital calculation?
No, I never did that. No.
Had you seen Jack Roberts' book at that time?
Oh, sure, yeah.
It came out just about then.
Oh, yeah. It came out before then. I mean, I had been working through Jack Roberts' book, and I'd worked through Streitwiser's book. I was already teaching this stuff in my courses. A little bit, as early as I got to Wisconsin in 63 or thereabouts. Although I didn't do much of it because Howie Zimmerman was far ahead of me in this, and we split the course, and I let him concentrate on that. But I was already starting to think about that then. But that would not have sufficed to when I first started to do. Molecular orbital calculations of sorts was earlier, about 59 or so, 58, in work with Earl Eveleth. I don't think that was one of the papers I listed there, but we had made the nitrogen analog of sesquifulvalene, and what you have there is a fulvene unit in a fulvalenoid arrangement with a pyridine ring with the nitrogen of the pyridine in the 2 position. And so if you count the 2 formal electron pair bonds that are in the pi orbitals of the pyridine ring plus the nitrogen lone pair, then you have an electron sextet. And so it's electronically analogous to sesquifulvalene, in which you have a fulvalene attached to a cycloheptatriene or unit, fused. So this is a nitrogen analog of that, and in order to understand something about the molecular spectroscopy of that and the dipole moment and so on, we tried to do some molecular orbital calculations. And we did these in connection with a fellow named Stan Manat, who was then working at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So we published some papers with Stan and Earl Eveleth and myself. Earl, incidentally, subsequently became a professor of theoretical chemistry at Paris, one of the branches, Paris 5, I think it is. Eveleth, E-V-L-E-T-H.
I spelled it right, and then I decided you said something.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
So that was the first time we really began to do that, but that was in connection with kind of an old problem. It was a connection with the problem of a kind of a statics problem. How do you describe the structure of this thing? Whereas what I was trying to do in that paper in 1967 was to treat a dynamics problem, a kinetics problem. Why does the reaction go this way? And that's the essence of the orbital symmetry thing. You want to talk about transition states. Now, what I was totally unaware of at that time, and this is to be blamed on Woodward and Hoffman themselves, was that Fukui had figured all this out earlier. But again, he didn't put it into terms that we could really use. He did not have interesting organic problems that were begging for a solution. That all he had was explanations for well-known phenomena, things like why does chlorobenzene undergo electrophilic aromatic substitution, orthopara, that kind of old classical problems in organic chemistry.
So in other words, let me ask you if this is the case here. What you're saying, or this is what I take you to be saying, people could have still explained that with resonance theory. I mean, if you want to ask, why does it's the same way we teach organic.
Right, yeah.
You can give a resonance explanation.
That's right.
So even if MO is better in some way, from the point of view of the organic chemist, you're not necessarily getting anywhere.
That's right.
What you're saying here is that the Woodward-Hoffman thing was now applying this to something where resonance theory just couldn't.
Failed. Totally failed.
Right?
Exactly right.
That's an important point.
Exactly right. Now, I want to make clear also that in Roald Hoffman's, going back to this thing we were talking about at lunch, which was the Evans so-called application of to transition state theory of the idea of aromaticity. He did that by a valence bond, a resonance theory kind of argument, and it's false. It doesn't give the right answer because it doesn't tell you how many electrons you have to have. In other words, by Evans's line of argument, ethylene plus ethylene face-to-face cycloaddition should have been an allowed reaction, should have been an orbital symmetry, not orbital symmetry, but a resonance allowed reaction. And so what he was talking about was the Diels-Alder reaction, 4 plus 2, which he likened to a cycle of benzene. But if you extend his argument, which was that the more electrons you have, the more stable the transition state is going to be, then 4 plus 4 should have been even better. So two butadienes. Come in! Two butadienes going to cyclooctane, cyclooctadiene, should have been better. Hello?
So it's really the Woodward, it's Woodward stuff, the orbital symmetry that really, in a sense, begins to, as you say, open the window.
For me, it certainly did. It certainly did. Now I keep putting myself at fault because it should have opened up long before then, but so should it have for 100 other people out there. You know, we all saw that stuff and our jaws dropped. We said, why the hell didn't I think of that? It was all out there, you know what I mean? It wasn't, they didn't invent quantum mechanics. So, but what I was saying, let me just follow up on this business about M.G. Evans. Dewar claimed that Evans discovered the essence of orbital symmetry theory, and I take the opposite position. He did not discover, the one thing he did not do was to discover the essence of orbital symmetry theory. He talked about stabilizing transition states aromatically. That was a new idea. I don't derogate that. I think that I wouldn't want to belittle that. But what he did not have was an understanding of what constitutes aromaticity, because he was thinking in terms of resonance theory. That's a very important point. It lies at the heart of the conflict between Pauling and Huckel and the whole development of theoretical organic chemistry at that time. This whole process was delayed 25 to 30 years at least by Pauling's dominance of that argument. And it
Right, you asked me why, you know, I didn't refer to Huckel in my paper.
Yeah.
But just a very brief diversion. There are several reasons, but one is, I mean, I'm reporting on what people did not talk about.
Absolutely. Right? That's.
I'm not trying to rewrite history.
I understand. But what I'm saying is, it astounds me every time, over and over again, and so.
But, I mean, you act as though you're surprised. I mean, the fact that this happens in science continuously.
I know it's very discouraging.
Well, of course, Mendel's paper was published in some off journal someplace that nobody ever saw it. But I mean, how long did they just ignore that?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, but it just.
Yeah,
I mean, there is something about the necessity of a context for a discovery, right?
Absolutely. The time has to be right.
And sometimes, I mean, the insight comes in a context that's not prepared for. The ground is not, you know.
Absolutely.
The ground's hard and stony and won't absorb the seed.
That's exactly right. It's a very good metaphor. And that's exactly what happened in this case. But what Roald points out is, with respect to this M.G. Evans business, that the one who really had the insight about what constitutes an aromatic transition state and how important the number of electrons in the cycle is was this fellow Sirkin. And he published a paper as early as 1956 in which he pointed out that there are a whole bunch of reactions in which he had a number of examples, including things that we would call today things like 1,5 hydrogen shifts, Cope rearrangements, and things like that, which he recognized as being 6 electron cyclic transition states and therefore having aromatic properties. But he never followed up on that. It was just, again, one of these explanatory things which was published in obscurity in a Russian journal. Nobody knew about it. And Roald subsequently learned about it and, in fact, refers to it in the book that he and Woodward wrote, yeah. So there's another case in which people were looking the other way and they didn't know what Sirkin was talking about.
Hmm. I want to ask you another question about this period, now switching it to something I'm very interested in. And you, interesting, one of the little potted biographies in one of the papers you recommended me read, you mentioned, you know, they always ask you, what are your interests? And say, well, Professor Burson is interested in blah, blah, blah. And one of them says, and funding.
Yeah.
So one of my questions was, you know, is this like a flip remark because we're all interested in finding money for our work and you have something else in mind?
No, he spent half his time.
Right.
Maybe more than half.
But I'm very interested in the funding question here because one of the things I'm particularly interested in, I'm going to be working on this in the fall, is the support of this kind of, you know, things on orbital, showing orbital, proving orbitals, the correctness of orbital symmetry in these, you know, polycyclic ring systems that have no application to anything, getting supported by the AFOSR, right, and with other people, the ONR as well. And, you know, from having dug around in the Winstein archives, I know that Winstein and Roberts were both very heavily, they were, had advisory positions for AFOSR.
Yeah.
So I'm interested how you got onto that kind of funding and what did you have to write to get this? I mean, what kind of arguments did you make to get money from these people to support this very, quote, pure research?
That's a very interesting point. Now, let me just try to reconstruct in my mind the climate of that time. I can tell you that this was in the 1960s, beginning of the 1960s. I was getting funding not only from NSF, but also from NIH and from AFOSR, and I believe also from the Army Research Office. There were two. There was Air Force and there was Army. Right. I was getting money from both of them. I don't remember making any special concessions to application. I wrote a straight, flat-out research proposal because I knew who was on those advisory boards. I had served on advisory boards to the advisory boards. I remember there was a meeting that I attended in which a question came up, well, how can we persuade these mission agencies to continue funding basic research? And I was quite outspoken about it then, and it was clear that for a time at least, they were going to do that. In fact, there was a time when it was either AFOSR or ARO, Army Research Office, wanted to fund all of a person's research. And I remember being approached by an officer, I'll say it was ARO, I think it was, asking me whether I would accept such an arrangement. And this was the time, you may recall, when this whole business about the Mansfield Amendment came up, in which Mansfield wanted all of the research funds, federal research funds, to be put under a single agency rather than having multiple agencies. Now, the arguments in favor of that were whatever they were, I don't remember, but it struck me at the time as a very bad idea because, and I'm still convinced of that, because one thing you do not want to have is a target. If you have a political upheaval which makes research vulnerable, if it's all concentrated in one place, it can be obliterated by one bad guy in Congress. It's much better, it seemed to me, to have it scattered around, and the science community got into such an uproar over it at the time that idea was shot down, the idea of consolidating it, which I think was all to the good. But I was definitely approached by the ARO or AFOSR, one of those Army or Air Force mission-oriented agencies, to let them fund my whole program. And I didn't do that, so I kept going with the grants on, you know, one cycle to the next with them, and at the same time keeping up my grant applications to other agencies.
Was it the same reason? You were afraid that if they withdrew your research, everything would go?
Yeah, that was fundamentally it at the beginning. But later on, it got to be another reason, and I stopped even applying for those partial support grants. And that was a political thing. That came in the mid-60s. I was very upset about the Vietnam War. I had a son who was approaching draft age. I had another son who was 2 years behind. I did not know when the hell this thing was ever going to end. And I decided that somehow I could not put myself in the position of even indirectly associating myself with what we were doing in Vietnam. And so I simply did not apply. And I received communications from the officers of the agency essentially urging me to apply. And I didn't apply, and I essentially stopped asking for money from those agencies for, I don't know, call it reasons of conscience or whatever you want, but I severed my ties with that kind of activity. I didn't want, even indirectly, anything that I did to facilitate what we as a power were doing in Vietnam. I was so opposed to that whole thing. So, you know, for whatever it's worth, now at that time one could afford to be, to you know, do things for oneself, for principle, because there was a lot of other money out there. I had NIH pre-docs, I had NIH and NSF post-docs, NSF pre-docs. I mean, I had all the money. I had 25 or 30 students hanging around, and I really couldn't keep track of them. So what was the point of just collecting all this money? So, stop. Okay.